Thank you very much, Director Raptopoulos, and let me say that it is a great pleasure for me to be here, and I want to say a word of thanks to SAP for this invitation, and of course also to the London Business School for their role in this event. It's certainly a very interesting moment to be in Athens, and I regret to say that air traffic controllers have decided that I should not stay any longer, so that I will not be able to participate in the panel after these remarks, on account of the need to catch the last flight to Larnaca. Not the way I was planning to go to Austria, but there it is. It has been clear for some time, at least to some observers, that we have entered a new and different period in the evolution of economic life. That mechanical and statistical models based on the average performance in the post-war period are no longer worthy of trust. That we are faced with events and circumstances on a global geographic scale and a historical time scale that we have not seen before, and that we need to think freshly and try to understand what the new rules governing these circumstances actually are. I don't wish tonight to try to present myself as an oracle with all of the answers, but I would like to sketch out parts of what I believe some of the answers are. And I want to take a step back, actually, from the immediate circumstances of the financial crisis to point out one of the underlying conditions which may have changed fundamentally in the way we approach economic life. It's an old story, something that we have wrestled with for some decades, since 1970 at least in the United States, namely the cost of resources, the distribution of resource rents, and the effect of that, and especially the price of energy, on general profitability. Without getting into arcane discussions about the geophysical situation of the world, whether we have or have not moved into a period of actual shortage of petroleum and other resources, we clearly have moved away from an era of superabundance, an era that was inaugurated in the 1930s in the depths of the Depression by the discovery of vast resources around the world. We've come, in fact, through several decades when energy crises came and went, and into a period where these resources are likely to remain expensive, and where, therefore, the financial and economic surpluses, the profitability available for everything else, is accordingly somewhat reduced. Now, for a time, in the late 1990s, the effects of this were obscured by the technology boom. A moment of high investment and full employment, especially in the United States, that was fueled by venture capital and by bank credit, motivated by a remarkable and in many ways justified optimism in the potential of the new technologies in computation, communications, interpretation of knowledge, with a transforming effect on a wide array of industries and activities, everything involving data processing, communication, practically everything does. We are, however, today more into the consolidation than the expansion phase of this cycle, a cycle which one might describe as the process of creative destruction, as outlined many years ago by Joseph Schumpeter. And for the moment, the effects of that consolidation outweigh the creation in terms of the pure effect on jobs and livelihoods, incomes, and therefore the effective demand in the society at large. This is true of all productivity advances. More jobs are replaced by fewer, but it is going to be true in especially powerful terms when one has a transformation of technologies that operates as comprehensively across economic activity as this one has done. In the mid-2000s, credit mechanisms were again mobilized, both in the United States and in Europe, to fill the gap left by, in part by this consolidation and slowdown of investment in the technology sector. In the United States, the principal direction of use of those credit resources took a very particular form. Took the form of a state-pushed desupervision of the mortgage markets. That is to say, of a quite deliberate effort to expand lending to households on the basis, on terms that would not have been applied before. And it also entailed the takeover of a significant segment of those markets by firms that had a very aggressive and deeply questionable business model. A model that involved largely making loans to borrowers who would not previously have qualified, did not, were not able to document their income, did not have strong credit histories, and against properties which were in many cases appraised to have more book value than in fact the market would have supported. And then of course the mortgages were bundled, rated by the ratings agencies, tranched and securitized in such a way as to make them saleable to investors worldwide, and particularly to fiduciaries who were concerned about having high quality instruments in their portfolios. That market had, as I said, a fundamentally questionable business model, and I think in some ways it's fair to say that it was at its roots dishonest. That is to say, that it was a market which grew rapidly, not on the basis of loans that were expected to be repaid, but on the basis of loans that were not expected to be repaid. Loans that would in fact have to be refinanced or would default within a relatively short period of time. Loans, therefore, whose profitability depended upon earning a fee and selling them to somebody else before the inevitable happened. I say this, and in part, to avoid describing this phenomenon with the conventional and overused term of bubble, which is a mechanical metaphor, something that blows up, expands, and then collapses. Describes the physical process, but doesn't explain it, and has a connotation of innocence. Bubbles are things of great interest to children. There was, in fact, no great boom in housing construction in the United States during this period. What was going on were largely mortgages issued to people who were refinancing old loans, and in many cases, taking out cash for other purposes, medical bills, repair of their roofs or what have you, that they would otherwise have not been able to afford, the price of which was eventually that they were put in jeopardy of the loss of their homes. Meanwhile, in Europe, other things were going on. Commercial construction boom in Ireland, the housing boom in Spain, public borrowing in Greece, for an essentially similar purpose. That is to say, to keep the process of economic growth going on some apparent basis. And the activities did support growth, but they created fragility. And what happened, it seems to me, was an integrated credit event at the global scale. Because when the US crisis destroyed what was presumed to have been the value of residential mortgage-backed securities, RMBS and their derivatives, then investors seeking to protect themselves from further losses disposed of other weak assets and moved to the strong assets, the default-free, risk-free assets available in the sovereign debt of the large countries of Germany, France, and the UK, and above all of the United States. So you had a phenomenon of a global flight to safety, creating a common crisis of European sovereign debts, something for which the architecture of the Eurozone was clearly and obviously unprepared. That's a very brief, a desperately brief summary of my view of how the crisis that we are presently in began to unfold. And that view holds, again, that the crisis that began in August of 2007, which came to a first climax in September of 2008, may possibly be moving to a second climax as we speak, was not a burst bubble that was compounded by panic, but actually the collapse of an institutional framework for the support of economic growth. A framework which was undermined in part by the application of technologies and algorithms to the financial sector, technologies that were intended and purported and described as spreading risk and managing risk, but which in fact destroyed the foundations of trust and trustworthiness, confidence in counterparties that are required for a credit-based system to function. They made risk essentially untraceable and so spread a poisonous degree of real or apparent exposure across the world. A couple of years ago in the summer, I was at a small meeting in Umbria in Italy, sponsored by the Gorbachev Foundation. And I found myself the only American, about a dozen Russian economist members of the Academy of Sciences, an Italian or two, and President Gorbachev. So I had an opportunity to say a few words to him. In my part of my presentation, I said, "Mr. President, when Homer returns," this is a good story to tell in Greece, actually, "when Homer returns to tell the tale, the epic history of our time, he will say that the Russian mathematicians swept out of Muscovy in 1991, presented themselves at the gate of Wall Street, bearing the gift of quantitative risk management models. That they were received with joy and set to work, and in 20 years they had destroyed the place entirely." And that this was clearly the greatest Trojan horse operation since Troy, and that he would, no doubt, "Mr. President," I said, "you will be remembered in history not only for having dismantled Soviet communism, but also for having engineered the destruction of Western finance capitalism." And he said, "I've been accused of worse." If there's a solution to this problem, if I've described it with any degree of accuracy, I do not know what that solution is. But I think the experience of the last 3 years should satisfy us that ignoring it will not make it go away. That denying it will not make it go away. And that it's at least a very plausible proposition that the world that we lived in up until 2008 cannot now be restored on any similar basis. I just put that proposition before you because it suggests that we have something more than the kinds of problems that we've been thinking we have. It has been official practice to to pretend by forecasting models that there's going to be a recovery. The cycle goes down and it goes up. That presupposes that you have a system which is ongoing and that carries out the patterns of the past or projected into the future. Maybe it's not so. Maybe we have something deeper that we have to deal with. And I think it calls into question something else. You will recall that in the heat of the crisis, there was a brief revival of ideas dimly remembered as being associated with John Maynard Keynes, a name I hesitate to mention at an event sponsored by the London Business School, but you will forgive me because I am a member of King's College, Cambridge, so I feel on moral grounds obligated to mention him at some point. But in any event, this revival was spearheaded by economists who called themselves Keynesians, or new Keynesians, but I think are perhaps better described as false Keynesians or pseudo-Keynesians, and whose views reached back not to the 1930s, not to this period of analysis and creativity and reconstruction of economics that actually was Keynes's task, but to the 1960s. And what they had extracted from that period was the logic and the formula of pump priming. The notion that there was a gap between the actual level of output, the potential level of output, and you could fill that gap by spending. Right? This was the conception of the stimulus package, built on top of an institutional framework which had a stabilizing element to it, but the notion was that you simply had a machine which had faltered. Perhaps it had run low on fuel, and if you added a little fuel, you could make it run well again. At worst, perhaps the fuel lines were clogged and they could be cleaned out. This was a metaphor that was greatly appealing to President Obama when he first took office. He said, we must get credit flowing again. The notion, again, is a plumbing notion or a fuel line notion that something needs to be pushed through a tube. But there was another possibility, which is that the pistons and the gears had melted down. That putting fuel into a machine which has been fundamentally impaired was not going to work. And I suppose it's also true that the illusion that we were not in a situation comparable to the 1930s was maintained and fostered by the fact that we have public institutions that have been built up over the intervening, 80 years, that buffered the extent of the shock. That is to say, we are much wealthier than we were, and we have stabilizing institutions, social insurance programs, and unemployment compensation, and disability relief, and food stamps in the United States, and all kinds of things that mean that the immediate effects are not as severely felt. They don't immediately show up in the collapse of business and the turning out of a large share of the population onto food lines. But what they do imply is that the effect of the shock is transferred to the public budgets, with the result that everywhere in the world, tax revenues collapsed, spending rates went up, and public debt mounted, causing or opening the opportunity for the conversation to be shifted, as it has been shifted in a most dramatic way, from the crisis itself and from the financial foundations of that crisis to the conditions of public finance, to the story of debts and deficits, so radically contradicting again the assumptions in the case of Europe of what a normally functioning European country should be expected to do. While at the same time, the kind of institutional and architectural change that had characterized the 1930s never made it on to the agenda. It's not entirely true. I mean, I think it is true that here in Greece, those changes, the need for those changes, were recognized. But of course, it's very difficult to make deep reforms of public administration in a condition of financial, overpowering financial pressure. It may be difficult to make them without that pressure, but it's very difficult to execute them if the overriding requirement is simply cutting budget numbers and not changing the way people actually operate in their jobs. Even with the stimulus packages, even with that momentary Keynesian presumption, of course, the return to normal did not occur. In the normal course of events, one has a publicly assisted beginning to the recovery, and then after a certain amount of time, the mechanisms of private credit and private finance take over. That hasn't happened, and I think we are past the point where a reasonable person will expect it will start happening anytime soon. Those who did predict that there would be a return to normal in quite a few countries are no longer in government. In fact, even in the Obama administration, of course, there was a tremendous political reverse in 2010. Many of the people associated with these ideas at the beginning of the administration have left government. Governments in Portugal and UK have changed. So the ideas and discussion has moved along. And what has happened, actually not for the first time, has been that these Keynesian notions have fallen into disrepute. And all of this discussion has now been returned to an anti-Keynesian vein, a vein which perhaps is best described by Herbert Hoover's description of his own, in his memoirs, of his own Treasury Secretary, Andrew Mellon, as a man who would liquidate the farmers, liquidate the banks, liquidate labor, let people live a more moral life and allow more competent people to take over where the less competent people are driven aside. Herbert Hoover, no less, did not find this to be a very attractive view. There is a view that the markets will reward discipline, bringing out recovery, a view which now I think should be discouraged by the course of events, and a view that one should do these things because they're the right thing to do, because virtue demands them, rather than because there are any particular expectation of success. In this way, the foundation of the argument for austerity moves from being an instrumental foundation, that is to say, you should do this because it will succeed, it will reward, it will produce growth, the kind of argument that I think David Cameron was making when he won the elections in the UK. An argument's very hard to make when everybody knows it's not true. That is to say, to the moral foundation that you should do this because nothing else is morally tolerable, do it for the sake of virtue and virtue alone. That is perilously close to the way martyrs think. It's perilously close to the reasoning associated with the strangest kinds of religious fundamentalism. And it brings to mind, if I may say so, Albert Einstein's famous dictum, attributed anyway to Einstein as a great many things were, whether he said it or not, that insanity consists of repeatedly doing the same thing and expecting a different result. I find it difficult to demonize political figures. I try not to demonize my own president, Barack Obama, though I'm profoundly disappointed with the course of his administration. I would not demonize the present Prime Minister, Mr. Papandreou, or even the Chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel, who are caught in the currents of these discussions. History will judge what they really thought at any particular time, and perhaps they will tell us later on. But in practical terms, that's often not the issue. They are, in practical terms, frequently imprisoned by the forces that surround them, the power of banking institutions that remain outside of the control of control by the public sphere, institutions which can blackmail the world effectively by the threat of their own failure, and the limitations of advisors, which is to say, the limitations of the consensus of professional opinion, even of the best professional opinion available to political leaders. Professional opinion is always a problem. In a crisis, there's a theorem, at least I think there should be a theorem, if not, I declare a theorem, that the view of the consensus, because it is an average, is by definition always wrong. The consensus is formed by taking the optimists and the pessimists and coming to a view somewhere in the middle. And in a crisis, by definition, it's an extremist who is right. And the question, the difficult question becomes, who and how has the political will and the moral courage to say so? And to declare that you're going to go with one of the strongest views rather than with the average of all of them. That takes a kind of political leader that we actually do not have, I think, on the scene just now, anywhere that I'm aware of. And an illusory optimism can be maintained only for a certain amount of time. There comes a time when clinging to it is not only delusional, but actually comes to appear delusional to the ordinary observer. And at that point, I would argue that maintaining or pretending to believe that things will get better, prosperity is just around the corner, is the way it was phrased in the 1930s, goes from being objectively irrational to being also politically irrational. That is to say, you will find that the public no longer lines up or is even influenced by this form of reassurance. And at that point, the political leader has to break the shackles of that form of misleading optimism, or else he or she will sink with the ship. I think we're quite close to that point now, perhaps both in the United States, where the illusion of a return to normal of economic growth has been strongly challenged by the slowdown in economic expansion and by the failure to create jobs, and in Europe for reasons that you know as well as I, as it becomes increasingly clear that matters are moving toward a head. Is America finished? Does Europe have a future? Will Greece survive as an independent state? Is our true future history dissolution and collapse? Should we take a new look at the not so distant experience of the USSR, which we've relegated to a memory hole as something not relevant to our own time? These questions have a dramatic quality, but in some ways they are before us today. And this is the point in a talk like this when one normally turns to prescription. It's a dangerous moment. It's particularly dangerous, I think, for an American in Europe. And I don't speak of myself, I speak, of course, of Secretary Geithner, who just came over here a few days ago. And what did he say? He said that you should do it the way we did it, with a massive bailout recapitalization of the banking system. A mega TARP, Troubled Asset Relief Program. So it was enacted by the Congress at the end of September in 2008. Well, not so sure about that. 3 years after our own TARP, it's very much doubtful that anybody voted for it has been politically successful, and many people are no longer in public life who did, and of course very doubtful that it had the economic effect that Secretary Geithner wants to claim. So turning to what Europeans are saying, I would like to express admiration for what is called the modest proposal by Professor Varoufakis at the University of Athens and Professor Stuart Holland of the University of Coimbra in Portugal, which has been backed by numerous senior European political leaders. And that takes the elements of establishing a full faith and credit Eurobond system, commonly held across and backed across the European community, a common system of bank regulation, and an investment program to restart economic growth. It's a technical solution of considerable practical merit, and there are others that are on the table. I know that, notice that George Soros made a proposal the other day. So the question of technical solutions is certainly in front of you, in front of all of us, which is useful. It helps to overcome the notion that technical solutions per se are particularly difficult. They're not. The architecture of a technical solution may be relatively easily at hand. The problem is, of course, political. The problem is whether the leadership in Europe that is making the decision on these matters would prefer to have a solution or prefer not to have a solution. Partly a question of what are their motives, what are they attempting to achieve, what fate do they envisage for the peripheral countries of Europe, and partly a question of what do they consider it necessary to do for their own political survival. It seems that things will continue, therefore, until, and it could be quite soon, that there is a decision for them to stop. A decision that is motivated either by the politics of the north of Europe or by the popular reaction here and elsewhere. And that's, of course, something that will be determined by political and popular criteria rather than by economics. But as time goes on, surely the odds shift. And the question is, how should one prepare? And I don't mean protecting oneself personally, but I mean in a public policy sense. There are two arguments. One of them is against even thinking about these worst case scenarios, let alone talking about them, let alone writing about them, let alone considering what comes next, what might come after the euro, after the eurozone. But there comes a moment when, if competent and responsible people do not address that issue, then incompetent and irresponsible people will start taking it up. And at that point, the situation could go from bad to much worse, from controllable to uncontrollable, from orderly to disorderly, from salvageable to unsalvageable. So I would just like to suggest, in closing, that the moment to begin that discussion is now. Not because one is committed to that outcome, it has enormous costs and dangers, but because it's only perhaps by facing those alternatives that one can move toward, effectively toward the better outcome, toward the stronger outcome, toward the outcome of a still unified, yet growing and prosperous Europe, which would be the outcome, I think, that would be of advantage and profit to business communities everywhere, particularly necessary for those in a country such as Greece. And if that is the desirable outcome, it may be that the way to move there is to begin to discuss in a serious, unemotional, practical way the consequences of going in the other direction. Thanks very much.